todo el mundo.
But this was really
1981.
Welcome to the Rock and Roll Nightmares podcast. I'm your host, Stacey Lane Wilson, author of the Rock and Roll Nightmares book series and director of the documentary The Ventures, Stars on Guitars. This is your destination for all things rock, where the interviewees include musicians, authors, historians, filmmakers, and more. And now, on to the show. My guest today is Jillian G. Garr. She's a rock author and journalist who has written for many publications, including Mojo, Rolling Stone, and Goldmine. Her previous books include She's a Rebel, The History of Women in Rock and Roll, Entertain Us, The Rise of Nirvana, and Bruce Springsteen at 75. She's here to talk about her newest book, a gorgeously put together hardcover called Queen, A Night at the Opera at 50. Let's get her on the line to tell us all about. Let's welcome Jillian to the Rock and Roll Nightmares podcast. Hi, Jillian.
Hello.
So, Jillian, A Night at the Opera is widely considered Queen's landmark album. What specific elements, musical innovations, production techniques, or creative risk do you think believe elevated this album to its current iconic status?
It certainly has a lot of different musical styles on it. And I think that's why it's frequently compared with the Beatles' Sgt. Pepper, which was also an album of many varying musical styles. And they also, for each album, they pushed the technology that was available at the time. Because the producer, Roy Thomas Baker, has pointed out, he felt the album doesn't get as much acclaim for the technical innovations as it should have. Because there were things that, especially now, when you look back, he said a lot of those sounds now you could just create by flipping a switch. And then you actually had to create it by hand, actually, somewhat literally. All these kind of things, just little things. I don't know if I'd known this before I worked on the book, but I'd read that how, for example, when, say, Brian or John would record a guitar or bass part, they'd record it in three different ways by plugging the guitar into an amp, plugging the guitar directly into the console and other things, and then taking those three signals and mixing them together. So I think that's why you get so many unique sounds on the album, because it's not just someone playing guitar with a bit of distortion. It's taking these three different ways of recording a guitar and putting them all together, which was a technique Roy said he later used on Carr's album.
Your book takes a deep dive into each song on A Night at the Opera. Can you share your approach to analyzing these tracks and maybe highlight one song that revealed unexpected layers during your research?
Let's see. There had already been books out in that series by the publisher, so there was a template for how you set the book up. So I just went with that. That made it easy to decide how to do it. First chapter takes the band up to when they record it. Then there's a whole chapter on the recording of it. Then you have to talk about the individual songs, side one and side two, because, of course, they were albums then with two sides and not just like a CD. It was, in a way, that was the most challenging part, because you'd think it would be easy because I know the album so well. But people have written about these songs for half a century.
It's your own personal take on it, though, which nobody else has. So that's
That's
what I
true.
liked about it.
Yeah. I tried to think that way myself. And especially challenging in a song like Bohemian Rhapsody, which people have written about endlessly and endless debate about what it means, what's it really about. And one thing I realized was that when I first heard the album, and this is at the time it came out, so this is 75, I never considered those questions. Maybe in general, you didn't do that then, unless you were recording something, but it just wasn't. And so people try and make these things immersive experiences. And sometimes I think that gets taken too far, where, say, everyone has to sing along during a concert with the band performing. And I think, God, can you just not do that? But it never crossed my mind to even wonder what Bohemian Rhapsody was about. I just liked it as a song. So that was interesting to reflect back on that. And maybe in a way, it made me think Freddie might have appreciated that, because he pretty much never talked about his songs and never said what they were about. They obviously meant something to him, but that wasn't something he wanted to talk about. And he'd just say, whatever you get out of the song, that's fine. And Brian said something along those lines that he never really knew what the song was about. And he said, if I did, I probably wouldn't tell you.
Oh, the Bohemian Rhapsody scene in Wayne's World. That movie was released just a year after Freddie Mercury passed, if I'm not mistaken. Do you know whether that song was originally in the script or was it included as a tribute following his death?
Oh no, they were making it while he was still alive. It was the last year of his life, 91. So yeah, it was nothing to do with that and nothing to be meant as a tribute. I read up on that part, and there were two different stories that came out that I think it was Brian May had said that, oh yes, at the time he was, I think maybe Freddie was still alive then, but very ill. Oh yes, they sent us a video with an excerpt and was it okay to use it? And we said, fine. Whereas in an interview with the director, Penelope Spheeris, she doesn't remember that happening at all. And she said, we wouldn't have really had the time to do that. So who knows what happened? I think they did want to put a different song in, but then they just plumped for that one. And actually, the cast members were a bit sorry by the end because they're shown headbanging in that sequence
I've heard
for a
that's
few
true.
minutes. And but then they had to film it over and over again. And by the end of the day, they all had headaches and their necks hurt. And
I'm sure they look back on it fondly now, though.
yeah, now then it became an iconic scene. Yeah, I'm sure they're pleased with that. I remember thinking, and this is when the movie came out. I'm watching it for the first time when it comes out in 92. And yeah, they're picked up and they're these kind of headbanger metal guys. And of course, it is the 90s. It's not the 70s. But I just thought, God, the metal guys I went to high school with would never have been listening to Queen. Yeah, they'd be the ones making fun of Queen. I was, and a similar thing. I remember I was saying this in another interview with how the album came out when I'm in high school. And no high school teenage boy would dare admit to liking a group called Queen. That was just too much for them. And it was, they were more a group they'd make fun of. Only girls could say how much they love Queen and Freddie Mercury. But when I went to see them for the first time in 1977, there were plenty of guys in the audience. They probably more guys than girls, actually. But so that was interesting. I thought, gee, maybe teenage boys are just too uptight.
Totally okay to love Queen for any gender. But following Freddie Mercury's passing, Paul Rodgers and Adam Lambert have each fronted Queen. From your perspective as a music historian, what neat qualities did each vocalist bring to the band while still honoring Freddie's legacy?
I was lucky to be able to see both of them, both singers with Queen. And Paul, of course, has this strong, powerful rock blues voice. So he was good on the harder rock numbers, I thought, but not as good on, I'll say, the more theatrical numbers. And this friend of mine was saying, oh, you have to see Adam with Queen. He's wonderful. He's amazing. And she's seen him a couple of times and they did come to Seattle, but I don't know. I couldn't get a good seat or something. I didn't want to pay more than work to get a better one. So I didn't go. But for this book, they were doing a tour of the West Coast. And I thought I should see them for the sake of this book to put that in there. Plus, I thought it would be good to see them. It's not quite the same experience as watching a live clip on YouTube.
Right.
That'd be suitable, but I think it's better to get the live performance. They weren't coming to Seattle on that trip. They were going to San Francisco and Los Angeles. And I picked San Francisco because their light rail goes all the way to the airport and it doesn't just head in Los Angeles. So I thought it'll be really easy to get to downtown Seattle, San Francisco, right? You see the BART train, so I'll go there.
Wow.
Absolutely. I had some airline credits, so I flew first class and drank sparkling wine on the way down and made it. That was my tribute to Queen. And the arena where it was held, it even had a champagne bar. So I went and had champagne there.
Oh, wonderful.
And Adam was just wonderful. And I could see what my friend meant. Because, yeah, he does have that theatrical side. He has the campy side, which Paul couldn't do. In fact, he said he was ill-suited for it when it was announced that he was going to be doing these shows with them. He said something like, and I won't be wearing tights.
Thank goodness for that.
But Adam, I don't know if he wore tights, but he did have a lot of different outfits and he could camp it up and ride out on stage on a motorcycle. They had that there. And he was just having such a good time with it and such fun. That was the tribute. It was such fun. And they even worked in, Freddie, they showed a clip from one of the last tours. They didn't say if it was, it probably wasn't Live Aid. It was probably the shows after Live Aid, the victory lap, doing the call and response with the crowd. And so you hear that call and response with the crowd, but it's also being shown in this big arena. So real crowd was also doing a call and response.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, yeah. So it was just, it was nice that they were able to do that again. So I read in one interview I read with Brian saying, no, this is after Freddie's death. And there, I think he still did music, of course, he's played live, but they were driving somewhere and going past some big arena. It made him nostalgic and he thought, I'll never be playing those kind of places again with Queen. But then Queen came back and they were playing big arenas. So that gave him some satisfaction to keep the music out there and keep it alive. So yes, if you like Queen at all, I would recommend going if they go out there again. Of course, Brian and Roger are getting up there in age. So who knows how much longer they'll be able to do.
That's true. Yeah. Lady Gaga derived her stage name from Queen's Radio Gaga, and we talked about Wayne's World. So what other significant ways have you observed Queen influencing contemporary artists and popular culture?
Oh, geez. I'm not really sure, actually. Maybe was it Radio Gaga that used the Metropolis footage?
Oh, yeah. And then there's the movie, too, right?
Yeah, maybe it made people appreciate, made them want to seek out that. Where's that footage from? Oh, it's from the silent movie, Public Trouble. Maybe it got people to check that out. Yeah, the movie. I have conflicted feelings about biopics because I just think they change too much of the story. And the real story is always more interesting.
Oh, yeah. They definitely play loose and fast with the facts on that. I thought Rami Malek was really good, though.
Yeah, he was. It reminds me of the Doors movie with Val Kilmer. It was a performance. And but yeah, the movie, especially now, after I learned more about the Doors and then watching the movie and thinking, wow, they really got all this stuff wrong. But then there are restrictions. And I don't know of any with the Queen thing, but for example, I had read that with the Doors movie, and I think it was just called Oliver Stone, that Pamela Corson's family, because that was Jim's girlfriend, and she inherited his estate when he died, and then she died a few years later. And then I think eventually it was split with the Morrison family, too, after a legal thing. But the Corson family had stipulated that the filmmakers could not use any of Jim's poetry, which they had the rights to.
Ah.
The film implied in any way that Pamela was involved with Jim's death. So you have these kind of compromises that come in. I'm not sure if anything like that happened with the Queen. I know some things that they just made up. I know you can't put everything into a film and you condense things, but some things just never happened at all. And I always wonder why they do that.
Yeah, that's a good question. I thought of another pop culture kind of Queen connection is that We Are the Champions is often played at sporting events.
Yeah, both sides of that single. We Are the Champions and We Will Rock You. Yeah, you hear that. You got that because it's got that classic beginning. Womp, womp, womp. Tailor made for sports arenas. You can play We Will Rock You at the start of the game, and then you can play We Are the Champions at the end.
You're right.
It kind of suits both then.
I want to get back to your book a bit because it is not only meticulously researched and beautifully put together, but the hardcover has a slipcover. It's just so luxe, which I think is fantastic. It's got a really distinctive layout and design element. So what was your emotional response when you first saw the finished book, and how does the format enhance the reader's experience?
I've been doing for motor books for a while, and this is, I'm looking at myself. It's the third one, and the other two had slip cases, so I needed to put two. So you get, when you're working on it and when it's done, you get to look at a PDF to see if you think you change direction. And you see the complete book and you see the cover, and I think it even saw what it's like, but then it's a very different, right? When you actually have physical book in your hands.
Yeah.
And when I got it, I remember looking, as you say, this, and then on the side, there, the spine is in gold. And I thought that was, that was very exciting. They do a great job.
Your research for the book covered everything from Queen's costumes to Brian May's Red Special guitar. What was your research methodology, and did you uncover any facts that surprised even you, or things that dedicated Queen fans might not know?
Now with the internet, it's a terrific resource to articles. And being a fan of Queen, I already had a number of books. I think my favorite is Real Life by Mark Blake. I think that's the best overall Queen biography. But while I was working on it, I learned about things like Brian's guitar, the Red Special. They put out a book about this. Is how I was able to make use of that. So Mary Austin, Freddie Mercury's longtime girlfriend, who had inherited much of the estate, she had a huge auction the other day, sell out possession. There were many. And with auction, especially major ones like that, they always have a catalog.
Right.
And those can be fascinating trove. I got the catalog. It's a little more elaborate than some of them. Some of them are just soft cover, but this is hard. So this just had all kinds of things in it, like an early draft of the Bohemian Rhapsody lyrics, pretty good, titled Mongolian Rap. And then it also had the sneakers that he wore during the live aid. You could think pretty, just in his jeans and these, and you could mention the exact type of sneaker. That's fun to do that thing. But also, the internet gives access to so many articles that you might not necessarily, that you probably would discover elsewhere. But who knows if they were in a magazine? What magazine was that? How would you track that down? I found a really fascinating article, interview with Roy Thomas Baker for Sound on Sound, news magazine, it's more technically oriented, not a mainstream, about the technical aspects of the recording. So that was immensely useful. He was talking about Bohemian Rhapsody, but he also ended up talking about the other songs on the album and how they were put together. And I remember it was in that one or some other interview he had done where he talks about things like For the Prophet song, the Wailing Wind, that they got that sound from an air conditioner. He showed this kind of mystical song that came from something, the sound came from something as conveyed as an air. And then I compared the scene. There were two DVDs with Queen's videos on them. And they had bonus. They first came out of VHS, then DVD, and they had the bonus. And one of them, I think it's called Behind the Map. And it's Brian taking you through the song Behind the Map. And what he does is he's in the studio, and he can cue up the different parts. He can hear how it all came together. This is how we did this vocal. This is how we did this vocal. And that's fascinating. Yeah, I love finding things like that.
Speaking of delving in, I know that you've written books on Nirvana, Elton John, Bruce Springsteen. Now, as someone based in Seattle, how does your location influence your music writing? Obviously, Nirvana is from the Pacific Northwest. What draws you to choose such varied artists also as the subjects of your books, because I can't think of three more different artists than Nirvana, Elton John, and Bruce Springsteen.
Some of them, like Elton John and Springsteen, those were the ideas of the publisher, writing a book on such a, and then pretty much always going to say yes, because it's great when people offer you work. And you
absolutely,
pitch an idea. If a publisher says to you, are you interested in such and such a book, that means they've already decided they want to do it. Now, the Queen book was one, because they had put out a book on Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon in 73. So I started thinking, what other books have big anniversaries? Or what other bands have big anniversaries coming up with the big album? So I'm looking what else came out with 73.
I'm wondering, what common threads have you discovered in the creative process of all these disparate but iconic artists that you've written about?
Let's see. I know the first book, She's a Rebel, The Spirit of Women and Rock and Roll, that was, I remember being told, that'll be your hardest book. You'll all be reading about. And that was true. That also was just about so many artists. Very different kind of book. A lot of the things I've written since then and just one artist. And that's much easier when you're focusing on one person or band. I've learned that the earlier years are often the most interesting period for an artist before they get incredibly successful. Usually there's some kind of obstacle to get over. I know they talk about saying, think about some of the major artists that started out really impoverished. And I think maybe all the artists I've written up, perhaps Jimi Hendrix had the roughest upbringing. And I know Elvis was born in a one-room shack that had no electricity and running water, but he had a stable family. He always worked and never hungry. Whereas Jimmy, he was born in a hospital. But after that, he was very turbulent family set up. His parents that were always fighting before they finally divorced. And his father was an unskilled laborer, so just getting what worked fine and not always having a job, or even when he did, not having the money. And just, I lived not far from neighborhood Jimmy would have grown up. And just how people in his neighborhood who were also low in would be giving him their clothes, or inviting him to come in and have dinner, because he and his brother might not have been fit. Not everyone faced all the obstacles that he did, of course. That someone like Elton John, he had a very middle upbringing throughout. But just, those early years, they have more of a struggle. And the sense of drive, I realize a lot of these people, they just need to have a sense of drive if they're really going to make it. That's certainly another thing. They all had there's so many people in lockdown that don't. And I think perhaps that underlying ambition is not there. But then also luck or chance or fate, whatever you want to call it, that can play a huge role too. And that's something over which you have no control. Elton John is working at this. The guy there, his boss, gets a letter from Barry Taupin saying, I'm a songwriter. Lyric. I'm very, you have a musician to hear me. And so this guy hands a letter to Elton, says, oh, maybe you could work. And just so random. What if Elton John hadn't been there that day and the guy read the letter and thought, oh, I'll pass it on to Elton, but then he forgets for something. You know, just, or even, I've thought about, it took me years to think about this, but I realized that they were Elvis. So he and Scotty and Bill are recording with Sam Phillips on July 5th. The song is going to come out okay, but nothing exciting. And they're taking a break and on back. And then Elvis starts fooling around on the beat-up song, That's All Right, Mama. And the other two join in, and they're forcing around. And Sam Phillips picks his head and says, what are you doing? No. When does it start and do it again? He hears. And that's the moment. And, what if it was another producer who just, they're taking a break. They're not trying to record it. Another producer who just listens for the song and claps his hand. All right, that was fun. Let's get back to work. and then the moment's gone, and then history is changed. Just those weird random moments. I guess you could say that in King's story, that what if Brian hadn't checked up a notice on the board at college saying, we're looking for a drummer, and Roger Taylor hadn't seen it? What if Roger had walked down the hall and didn't see the clog and notice?
Oh, I know. It's crazy making to think about how many different elements of chance have factored into anyone's success or even failure.
Yeah.
My last question is, what do you hope readers will take away specifically from Queen, A Night at the Opera, 50 Years, that might differ from your previous works?
I guess even getting a new appreciation for the album and all the work they put into it, both creatively and because it is a marvel to that. I think even people that don't necessarily like the album would have an appreciation for those aspects. And just how hard they work. It was hard for them to get to the breakthrough of Night at the Opera. But then after that, for the next couple of years, they were just, if they weren't making an album, they were on the road. Sure. And when you get to that level and you're doing those kind of big extensive tours, that could be tiring too. Yes, you're a hit act, but it's not easy. They were very dedicated, hard work throughout it. They really had that work ethic instilled in them.
Yes, I definitely took that away from your book. And is the book out now?
Yes, it is out now.
All right. So where can fans find the book?
Of course, it's the usual big online retailers, but I always suggest people go to an independent bookstore. If a book is in print, then a good bookstore should be able to order. And a lot of good bookstores now have their own online sites you can order. Like here in Seattle, you'd go to Elliott Baker, is the best bookstore in town. And they have a website. So, you know, you don't even have to go into the store and think, man, you could do it online and they can take care of that for you.
Fantastic. Thank you, Jillian. I really appreciate you being here on the podcast. And best of luck with this book. And I can't wait to see what you come up with next.
This concludes another episode of the Rock and Roll Nightmares podcast. Remember, there's a book series too. All the books are available in paperback, ebook, and audio via Amazon or the Rock and Roll Nightmares website. That's rockn-roll-nightmares.com. Our official theme song is She's Out for Blood by Fuzzbuster, founded by Lars Cabot. Thank you for listening. Well, she